So you have two email addresses?
Mother Agnes is on Hotmail, and Mother Margaret is on Hotmail as well. And I just use the convent one.
Oh, I see. That's
Carmel. Fayum Carmel. Fayum Carmel.
I'd like to introduce you to four women.
I spent my years in Matarilla putting cement on walls.
That's Margaret Therese.
And up on the ladder, an awful lot of my time.
Sister Margaret Therese.
Whitewashing walls.
She's 83.
Everything on the cheap, you know, it wouldn't cost much.
That's Sister Agnes. She's from Loughrea, County Galway. She's also in her 80s. And do you know the name of those birds under there?
They're they're the ibis, a sacred bird. Nobody would kill an ibis. It goes back to the time of pharaohs. You know,
this is Sister Veronica, almost 80.
And did marvellous. This might be Mother Agnes calling.
She's just taken the tiniest blue mobile phone out of her habit pocket.
Oui. Nous sommes... Hein? Oui. Nous sommes là maintenant.
About yourself, do you remember what you were wearing?
What are the questions?
Sister Martina, the Joker. She's in her early 80s.
What else do you want to tell me?
Many years ago.
When I was taking the nuns' photos, she was the one who broke a branch off a bush and stuck it up behind Sister Margaret's head. The Carmelite convent where the nuns live is in Egypt, in an oasis called Fayoum, about a 2-hour drive southwest of Cairo. It's a lush rural area, watered by the Nile. The convent is on the edge of the desert, about 20 minutes from the main town, which has around 1 million people. Seven nuns live in the convent. Four of them are elderly Irish. It used to be a cattle farm, and the sisters converted the buildings and outhouses into a chapel and retreat house.
Well, it was filled with cows. It was full of cows. Lots of dung. That's why the trees have grown so enormous all around.
Sister Veronica is from Lusk in North County Dublin.
That would mean we have about 35 or 37 acres. Maybe 30 of those would be under trees, mango and olive trees. And then a small area under date palms. Zaidi Shaper. Zai. The soil gets so clammy when it has water in it that if you were to walk into it, you'd leave your shoe behind, you know. Incredible. Oh, I know it by experience. It looks fine, you begin to walk, and then you suddenly find they're beginning to have water here, and no way can you get across. It just floods everything. And it's even more risky now because it's watered more often than in the old days. We've about 15 different varieties of mango, at least 15. Some of them are magnificent. We don't harvest them ourselves. We sell our garden, if you like, to a man who's used to doing that. He has his workers, and he comes along and offers his price in the month of April, May, when he sees, they have an eye to the tree, you know, and he walks all around it, and he'll offer you a price. Alkanis, are you ahead?
Even when the Irish nuns are on their own, they speak French to each other. There's a reason for that, which I'll tell you about later. The nuns go into town once a week to buy provisions, go to the bank and get money for the farm.
What we get for the farm we put in and then we keep drawing it out. What a man said one time, I never saw people, they usually put money into the bank but you'd always taken it out.
That was a good one.
So this is the sweeter wine, isn't
this
it?
This is a sweeter wine now.
Is it first class?
It's full. It's first class.
First class.
First class. And somebody told us that if you were in France and you had wine that was hand-pressed, you could ask any price for it. They used to make it even before we came. We had a sister from Alsace. I'm going to say an Alsatian. She used to make it. She showed me. I was interested in making it. Nobody could drink it. She believed in not putting any sugar into it at all, you see. And eventually, to help us to drink it, she used to put a cognac into it, you know. But I was interested in the wine, and I kept on trying to make it. It's really, really making it for mass, to have mass wine. But the priest and the Egyptians don't like a dry wine. They want it sweet. Just last week now, I sold a case. And then we use it ourselves, and we give presents of it. And I laugh at myself because our family name is Cusack. My eldest brother was very keen to find out where these Cusacks came from, you see. And he ended up anyway in the south of France. And there's a village there called Cusack. It's a vine-growing place, and it's a wine-making place. So he said, oh, this is where we got it.
It's in the blood.
It's in the blood.
So this is the way up.
That's very modern. This is very modern. That's great.
We're on our way into the convent.
You have two floors.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. After that.
From inside the lift, we can hear somebody playing the piano on the first floor.
Thank you.
No. Oh, there's somebody interesting. They didn't know you're coming in.
Sorry. Margaret plays the organ during Mass and Vespers.
They didn't realise you're coming in. There's somebody practising music.
Oh. And she also gives music lessons to the younger sisters in the evenings.
This is a place for music as well. We have the two postulants.
See how slow that is now.
There you have, I see 29 spans.
The technology room is on the second floor. This has the computer for the internet, the photocopier, and a scanner.
The first computer we got was a gift from, there were Americans in Imadi, and they had been coming here on retreats, actually. It was a Mac, which is different. I had to kind of learn this one afterwards. But it served me a lot because at the time I was doing the accounts for the community, and it was a marvellous help. The auditioning and everything just online.
The nuns use email to keep in touch with family and friends, as well as other Carmelite convents.
If I wanted to write a letter now, or two letters, I'd need about 3/4 of an hour probably to read down what I received and then get... 3/4 of an hour, 1 hour would be the just once a week for me. I used to make Christmas cards with photos, because there was a time when you couldn't buy a Christmas card in Egypt, and we were making nice little cribs. I said, wouldn't it be nice to photograph these and make a card of them? And so we did. We sent them to, you know, the Basilica in Heliopolis.
You have some photographs online there.
I have. We got them recently. Let's see what's it on now. Oh, here I get it in my photos from the Holy Land. One of the sister has a lot. Maybe I have to do two clicks here.
The convent in Fayoum is a work in progress. The Irish nuns moved here in 1995 from another convent in Cairo. It was the third major shift in their lives of nuns. The first, obviously, was the day each of them joined. Do you remember your first day?
I do. We went down to Nuras, my parents and my brother, and they gave us a meal in the parlour, and they were nice cakes, and my father said, "I like the cakes." He said, "You take them now, plenty, because you'll never see them again." So then I was afraid the time was coming to say goodbye, and I couldn't say goodbye, so I got up and dashed to the door to go in. But my father caught me like that, said, "You don't go like that." And then I had to embrace them and go in.
I asked to enter immediately. I finished leaving cert on the desk where I finished my papers. I wrote the letter. And in the meantime, anyway, at one stage, I felt as if I had no vocation whatsoever. I got a call to teacher training, so I'll do the call to training, and that's it. And at the same time, I had a rendezvous meeting with sisters in Loughrea. So I said, what'll I do? Oh, there's only one thing. I'll go and tell them I'm the vocation. So I went. And as soon as I got inside the door, I felt this is where God wants me to be. So instead of telling my vocation, I just carried on.
Oh, it was a battle. It was a hard fight.
In what sense?
In the sense that I didn't want to.
Really?
I didn't want to. And yet when I was growing up, I didn't want anything else. But I left, I did my leaving cert. I was just over 17 and I went home and announced that I wanted to be a nun and a Carmelite. And my father wouldn't hear of it. Too young, no question. Anyway, I got into this teaching course, 3-year course. And of course, we had our dances there and we had our, you know, and by the time the 3 years were nearly up, I said, it was all imagination. I was only a kid when I was thinking of these things. How do I know? What is it to love God and what to love somebody else? And it was all an imagination. So I set off about getting a job, and I got this place down in Kildare. And of course, down there, I met somebody and fell in love.
Wow.
And I got to the stage of bringing him home. And we were very close friends altogether. And then something began to nag at me. And I wondered. And I began, when I was down in Kildare, I was on the top of the world, everything was fine. And when I came back, I was at home for a weekend, everything went flat. And things didn't go at all, and I wouldn't go with the family. They were all golfer mad, you know, they used to go golfing on a Saturday and Sunday. I wouldn't go golfing without walking on my own. And I wasn't with it at all. So, of course, my mother saw that, and she said, look, go down to Ross Gray and talk to Pierce about it. So I went down.
Who's Pierce?
Pierce is my brother. So I drove down anyway and spent the day with my brother. And something he said, I couldn't tell you what it is to this day, don't know what he said, but it came like a thunderbolt to my head. I said, you just want to do your own thing, and you know right well that God wants something else. And I went into a flood of tears. There was a little one beside me, she looked up and she said, what's wrong with you?
And I had to get into my car and drive home that night. It was winter. Drive home as far as Kildare on my own, and it was grim.
What brought the tears?
That I had to go back and give up my boyfriend.
The difficult thing was to tell Mommy. I just didn't know how I could tell her, what he could say. Anyway, I wrote to Loughrea, and they answered me. And I left the letter hanging around, and she found it.
How did she react?
She said, "Is that letter for you?" I said, "It is." And she didn't say no, she didn't say anything, she accepted. And then Daddy, God rest his soul, I told him, or she told him, I can't remember that. Anyway, he said, "Well, you have cousins in different orders. Some were Mercy and the other Sisters of Charity. And why wouldn't you go with them?" I don't know what I answered, but I had no doubt at all that I want to be a Carmelite, that that's what God wanted me. And I suppose that's what I answered in some way or another. Mm.
One day I was cycling along and there was a man in front of me on a bike and I said, "Imagine I'll never see a man again." And also I thought that they said in the thing, the rule, that you slept on a straw bed, you see. So I had visions of this little room with a lump of straw in the corner.
When I was in the secondary, I can't remember what year, we were asked to do a devoir, as they call it, an essay, what we would do later on in life. So I had said that I want to be a nun and I would go to Egypt. And when I'd be 60, I would retire and pray.
What did you pack in your suitcase the day you entered?
There was a whole list.
That's right.
Dressing gown.
Yes.
Night clothes.
What else?
All your underwear. Yeah. Yes.
And there was a list.
Few pairs of shoes.
What type of shoes?
Black shoes, of course.
Low heels.
Oh, yeah. But they didn't say about heels.
Was there a special shop? Did you have to go to the special shop in Dublin? Garvin's. It was next to Pim's in Georgia Street. And they provided all the a black dress and a cape and a black bonnet and everything that you needed for
all the underwear.
All the underwear and the aprons. And that was a must. You had to have all that.
Were you allowed to bring a possession from home that meant something?
No, not really.
Really?
No.
You couldn't have a photo in your room of the family, right?
Yes, your name was taken away, not even your clothes. immediately your name was changed.
Yeah. Well, no, we kept our name for 6 months.
And was there one thing in particular that was hard to leave behind?
Oh, my bicycle.
Tell me about your bike. What was it like?
Oh, to rally.
Oh,
and it was really a good one. I was so proud of it. I went everywhere on it. I lived on it. I went up steep hills and flew down like that. And you could, but I never broke my neck with it. But I loved it so much so that a Franciscan priest who knew me in Waterford, he said, "Is the bicycle entering with you?" At that time, it couldn't. I left it with great regret.
What were you wearing when you entered?
Oh, I remember very well. Because I didn't bring my best coat, my sister wanted it. And all the things they liked, I wore the things they weren't interested in. I wore a grey skirt and a grey and a grey twin set. It was cold. Well,
I don't know whether you know a jigger. It was the whole the. It was one of these short coats, you know. It was the real style at the time, and I had a red one, and I had a red striped dress, and I had red sandals, Kay sandals, and I said neither of my sisters are going to wear any of that rig out, so I think that's what I'll wear down to Loughrea, and I'll leave anything else that they might wear, you see. So when they saw me coming in this, oh, she won't stay 2 days, this one.
When the two-coloured brown and cream shoes came out, I had a pair. I thought they were wonderful. And all the girls in school were admiring them. And they said to the teacher, "Look, Mother, look at the shoes she has."
Agnes didn't know it when she was a schoolgirl, but her essay about ending up as a nun in Egypt was about to come true. And what was it like coming into the airport on your first day?
Well, it was also a big experience. I was delighted. But we had a long wait, and there was, a man dressed up in pharaonic clothes walking up and down, and I was terrified of my life of him. We were sitting on a seat waiting for someone to come and fetch us, and he was walking up and down looking at us, and I was terrified of him. But I'm sure the poor man was harmless. So when they came, we were very pleased.
All of the nuns eventually ended up in a place called Matareya, which is just outside the city of Cairo.
They brought a minibus for us, and we were coming along, and the priest said, "I'm glad you're coming in the night time, because if you saw it in the daytime, you would get a shock."
The convent is beside a tree which, according to biblical lore, was the place where the Holy Family rested on their flight into Egypt. That story may have been charming, but for young Irish nuns, the climate was far from it.
I remember the first morning at Mass, all the windows were closed, were covered with curtains, heavy curtains inside, in our choir, and the division between the choir and the chapel was also closed. And at the end of the Mass, Mother Joseph fainted, because there was no air, and it was very hot. We arrived here on the 1st of October. It was very hot. The second day, Mother Veronica, the same thing happened to her. But thanks be to God, I didn't.
The nuns lived in Egypt at a time of major political upheaval. Nasser had just installed a socialist regime, and the government began confiscating lands and property from the upper classes. One group in particular which was targeted were the Coptic Christians, sometimes known as Greek Catholics.
A lot of people of the Greek Catholics used to come to us in Matareya asking for prayers. And evidently it was seen or watched. One night around 11:30, the police came and said that the house was in danger, and the sisters all have to go out, and they'd put the seal on it. And what they wanted, it seems, was to see, they thought that the Greek people coming were leaving their jewels and money with us, but they weren't actually. So Mother Joseph was in charge at the time, and she was a great character, she was well able to manage. So she said, "You don't come in the middle of the night to get sisters out. Wait till the morning." And they said it was urgent. So she telephoned the nunciature, and the secretary came over as quickly as he could, and a priest friend that they had in Heliopolis, he came over also. So they reasoned with them that the house would hardly fall down before the morning. So they went off, and the little money that Mother Joseph had, she had it in a cardboard box under the bed with nothing in the bank. You couldn't at that time. So she put it, wrapped it up in newspaper and gave it to the priest, and he put it under his arm as if it was his newspaper, and he went off with it. So the next morning, the bishop came and the secretary from the nunciature came back again, and the police said, "Oh, we're very sorry, we made a mistake, but the house is in another street."
The nuns lived in closed lives in a country where the culture was alien to them. But not only that, the culture within their own walls was also only slightly more familiar. The convent was founded by French nuns who fled Jerusalem at the end of the Second World War, and the spoken language was French. This made communication difficult.
I didn't know what they were saying. And one fine day I decided I was going to bring my dictionary. Both had brought English-French dictionaries with us, and I brought out the dictionary. Well, they could not get over it. They didn't enter their heads just how frustrating it is, like, to be there and not be able to follow. It released my frustration, and at the same time I got a few words, you know.
And as I said, all these years later, the Irish nuns speak French together.
On the down, nous sommes là aussi.
Even when they're alone.
Oui. Vous êtes derrière, peut-être. Oui. Alors, nous sommes ici en avant.
The Carmelites are an enclosed order. When the nuns joined, they understood their relations with their families would change forever. In Margaret's case, it hit her father most hard.
2 months after I entered, my father got pneumonia. And at that time, there wasn't penicillin and all that, and it was a miracle that he got out of it. But my mother said he went down after your entrance. He missed, you know, that was, it was hard on him, really.
Remarkably, Margaret's mother did make it to Egypt. But having travelled all those hundreds of miles from Waterford to Cairo, she wasn't allowed closer than a few feet.
And then when they came to see you, you were behind a grill. You could never embrace them or anything.
But all of this was about to change. ...1970 brought the second major event in the nuns' religious lives. After Vatican II, the order decided that the nuns should no longer be totally enclosed. They had been in Cairo between 5 and 11 years and had never even seen the pyramids. And after 17 years away, Agnes was allowed to travel home to Loughrea.
When I got near home, there was a whole range of cars out to meet me. And there were bonfires, like for a wedding. There were about 3 or 4 of them. And all the neighbours were out. And all of them were 17 years older than when I'd seen them before. And they all expected me to know them. Yeah, it was amazing. It was, it was.
It was decided that the nuns should interact more with the local community, and they wanted their independence. So they bought a car, and Veronica was picked as the designated driver. But Cairo traffic is not for the faint-hearted, especially not for a learner. However, there was one day of the week when it was relatively safe to venture out, the Islamic Day of Prayer.
She used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Friday and go out. And every day she didn't go a bit further. And then there was a man from Materia, a friend, who used to come with us. And he would drive part and she would drive part of the way. And by degrees she got into it and got very, very good at it.
And then there was a third major shift in the nuns' lives in Egypt. Gradually, it was becoming clear that the building in Matareya was no longer suitable as a convent.
We were up a narrow street, very narrow actually. When we came, it was only the width of, you know, and it was a dust track. And it became worse as time went on because the houses were building up all around us and there were mosques all around.
Matareya was grim, you know, it was very poor. The house, like, was very old, and no matter what you did with it, it couldn't improve it. And then in 1992, there was the earthquake, and it did a good lot of damage because the cracks everywhere, a bit of the ceiling fell down over the stairs. So we decided at that time that perhaps we should try and move. We were dreaming of building a monastery out in the desert, but, like, you have to be practical. How would we live? And on what would we live out in the desert? So that hadn't come into it.
For Margaret, she's an adventurer, a lover of maps, and she also adores the desert. This was to be an exciting time.
I was 30 years there, and I had never been outside. I'd never seen what the countryside was like or what the desert was like. I was often wishing I could.
You would be interested in seeing our cabin, our graveyard.
I would.
Come
yes,
down.
You did, yes.
Great.
It's being fixed up at the moment.
When Fayoum was chosen as a new home, the nuns had a decision to make. The old convent in Matarea had a small graveyard for deceased members of the community. The surviving nuns had to decide if they should take their late sisters with them or leave them behind.
Two died in a fortnight. Very difficult for us. Yeah.
And they're here with you now in the...
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had a cavo, a nice place, under the altar in the church in Matarea, and so it had to be emptied in Matarea. Mm-hmm. It was dreadful.
You're removing the remains?
Yes.
What we decided to do was we got somebody to help us to change all the bodies that remained and put them into three wooden boxes. And we put the three wooden boxes into the car. We said nothing to nobody.
And then they were put on a lorry coming, covered over. And, you know, you're always stopped at the checkpoint.
I was in the lorry.
Were you in the lorry? Well, tell her the rest of it.
Two of us used to come every week on a Friday when this gentleman lent us his... a covered-in lorry. You wouldn't call it a lorry, like a almost
pick up truck.
Kind of a pick-up, that's right, and covered-in. But we had all these behind us, and two of us were sitting up, and then the driver in the front. And we came to the checkpoint, and we just sat there, you know, and wondered. And we said, they never actually stopped at our check, but, you know, if they only knew what was going through.
Yeah. And you didn't tell the driver either?
No, the driver didn't know.
And when they arrived here, we didn't tell the men either, because that wouldn't do, so we had to put them in. The place wasn't ready for them. We put them in the garage in one side, and we told them nobody was to touch that side of the garage for a long time.
And how long do they stay there for?
Oh, they were a few months.
Oh, this is lovely down here. This is
would you call this a mausoleum, or?
This is where you put the coffin in. As you see, we get a plaque of marble and put the person's name and the date of birth and the date of death. They're all the people. I knew all those now.
Can you read some of the names?
Yeah, Marie de Jesus Crucifié. She's from Syria, Mother Mary of Jesus Crucified.
How do you pronounce that name?
Criserti. It's Roma. So Marie de Immaculée Concepción, she was from Brazil. She went to Jerusalem for a pilgrimage, and she decided she would enter in Jerusalem, and then she came here. And Sir Josephine of the Child Jesus, she is from Alsace, and when she was born, Alsace belonged to Germany, so she didn't speak French. Sir Joseph de l'Enfant Jésus, she is a Maronite. And she was born, her family were from Tarsus, where St. Paul is from. Sir Lulu Iskander, she's from Tanta. And as you see, she died in 93. There's a tremendous story about her.
She's Egyptian.
She's Egyptian. She was Orthodox. She became Catholic. And then she decided she wanted to enter with the Carmelites. And when she announced it at home, there was war. And they kept her at home. Never got outside the door until she was 21. And for her birthday, they were making a nice new dress for her. And they let her go out to try on the dress. And we gave her the money for the dress. Instead of going to the dressmaker, she went to the priest who knew her. And she told him, and he said, he looked at his watch and he says, now you've just time to catch the train, if you wish. So she went off to catch the train. And she had to pass by the building where the father worked, and she bent down her head under the window so he wouldn't see her. And she entered. And then, when they found she was gone, they sent out the police looking for her in all the convents in Cairo.
She used to write to the family. They would send the letters to France, and the letters came from France. After the war, they decided to let them know that she'd been here all the time. And they were very vexed, because they were very worried about her during the war. And the sister refused to speak to her.
There's a lot of history there, isn't there?
Yes, isn't there?
Many years. Like the earliest...
Yes.
In 1916.
They came here in 1914, and they left three of the sisters here. But no, normally, like, they should not have died, you know? It's probably the climate here. In the summer, it's very heavy. Because at that time, there was no such thing as adapting the habit to the climate. So they wear the woolen habit in the middle of the summer with long sleeves, and they wore woolen underclothes.
Wrong.
And changed them if they were fortunate, once a fortnight. So it's impossible to survive. When did you have extraordinary health?
Tell me about the habits that you were wearing.
Wrong. This we adapted after a while.
So it's a beige colour.
A beige colour, which, and you can see short sleeves.
Yeah. And what's the fabric?
Just local material. I don't know the name of it. Local material. We just get, you know, fairly light.
It looks nice and light for the...
It is. That's the idea. So that's it. Lovely to have all the nuns who came to Egypt, all of us together. You know?
The main religion in Egypt is Islam, and Christians, both Orthodox and Catholic, make up between 10 and 15% of the population.
How are the Christians getting on here? I noticed that quite a few of them were leaving. Seem to be an awful lot of people
trying to get
away. Young people,
if they can get out, they will. But they don't always do that that well. I mean, at the end of the day, you feel they'd be better off to stay at home. But they find it hard to... University students, sometimes you'll get into a taxi, maybe you've seen that yourself, and it's a doctor who's driving the... because he can't get work.
Groups of Christians often rent out space in the convent on special feasts such as Holy Days and Easter.
Every day there would be people coming for looking for prayers. They would either give you a donation of money or groceries. We never had to buy cheese or anything like that. There was an old sister and she was in the kitchen and the coffee was gone down to nothing. She put a little empty bag in front of the statue of St. Joseph in the kitchen and she said, "St. Joseph," it always came. Another thing was, when we hadn't any coffee one night, this man came to the turn. There was a turn around like that. You didn't see the person, but you put in your stuff, revolved. And he said, "I'm bringing you this coffee, and I intend to bring it to you in future every month." And now that's years ago, and he still sends it to us.
Really?
He's never missed out.
What made the people do this?
They have great faith in prayer. Have great faith in prayer, and they found, like, we were people that we didn't have a school or active thing, so that we were there for praying. So they had a better idea of us than we would have of ourselves, you know. So, and they're very generous. We found the Egyptians very generous, really. In the beginning of the month, we had nothing in the bank. You wonder where you're going to get the money for the month. And the only one time that I ever prayed for money was, we were coming to about the 27th of the month and practically nothing came in. So that day I prayed for some money and it all came in the 3 days that were therefore left. I did, yeah, definitely. So you'd have great confidence in prayer ourselves and in the Lord, his goodness to us, you know.
And you can see the mosque behind. That was being built when we came. It was being built the same time as we were building ours.
Yeah.
And one day they didn't have cement and they asked us for it. And another day we didn't have bricks and we asked them for it. It was nice.
Yeah. There we go.
Yes, there he goes now. That's his prayer time. God is a great God, is the only one. And Muhammad. Personally, I don't have much contact with the outside here. I don't know how many of us would know. And actually the people in the town of Fayoum itself are very nice, very friendly. They appreciate very much our way of life. Mm.
God worked so many miracles to bring us here. He's not going to let us down at this point.
That's what we feel.
And in the meantime, you still, you have your plans, you have...
Yeah, because you have to keep on moving, you know, and improving the place and all that, so that's what we're at.
It took time, but I suppose...
السلام عليك يا مريم يا ممتلية النعمة الرب معك مباركة أنت بالنساء ومباركة ثمرة بطنك سيدنا يسوع المسيح
يا قديسة مريم يا والدة الله صلي لأجلنا نحن الخطاة الآن وفي ساعة موتنا آمين
والكلمة صار جسدك
وحل فينا
السلام عليك يا مريم يا ممتلية النعمة الرب معك مباركة أنت بالنساء ومباركة ثمرة بطنك سيدنا يسوع المسيح
يا